This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
On Keeping the Faith this afternoon, we're talking about Islam and its relationship to Western civilization. Some have talked about a clash of civilizations. We're talking about that idea with two members from the Central Illinois Mosque and Islamic Center in Urbana. We're talking with Hatim Rahman, who is on the board of the Council on American-Islamic Relations. Welcome, Rahman.
Thanks a lot.
And we're also talking with Nasir Yahya, who is a senior at the University of Illinois and has been active in CIMIC for how long?
For about 6 years now.
Okay. So you both have been active in the mosque, and I appreciate your being willing to talk with us about this issue on the radio today. We will be taking questions and comments from listeners, so you might want to jot these phone numbers down. In Champaign-Urbana, you can give us a call at 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Elsewhere, if it's a long-distance call, do use our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. So perhaps you're listening on the Internet. You're in the continental U.S., do call us at 1-800-222-9455. Well, let's talk about this idea. Rahman, let's start with you, and I apologize for not quite pronouncing your name correctly. Why don't you say it so listeners will know how it should be said?
Sure. My name is Hatim Rahman, and I just wanted to say a little bit, I mean, dealing with this notion and I guess the organization that I'm involved with. So CARE, this is the university branch, and it ties into the national branch, which
and
is
CARE is CAIR.
Sure, right, and it stands for, again, the Council on American Islamic Relations, and it's the largest civil rights and advocacy group for Muslims. And on the campus, we, in order to live up to our mission, which is to enhance the peaceful understanding of Islam and encourage dialogue and protect civil liberties, empower Muslims, and build coalitions. And we do this through a bunch of different ways, and including putting on different events and inviting speakers. But that's
how,
just a little
bit. How many people would be involved in CARE?
Usually we can get, on the board we currently have 4 people, and then the members on our mailing list we have about 200, and then active to events, actual planning events, can be about 10 to 12. So it's a small organization, but it's a committed organization that's really dedicated to working with others in the community.
Now you're a student, right?
Yeah, this is my second year on campus. I'm in the College of Business and also the Technology and Management program at the university.
Now, are you an undergraduate or a graduate student?
I'm an undergraduate student.
Okay. Yeah. And where did you come from?
My parents, we've been residing in Naperville, Illinois for quite a while now, so that's where we reside.
You went to the Naperville public school?
Yeah, high school? I've been through all three of to the elementary school, middle school, and high school there. So
in Naperville. Yep. And how did you get involved in CARE? Was that before you came here to the University of Illinois or since you've been here?
Yeah, I mean, I've been familiar with CARE for a long time. It was founded in 94, 95 in the U.S. And just the idea of really, working with others and empowering people to be constructive in their communities is really, I felt, was very attractive because, I mean, especially with so many things going on, especially after 9/11, with so much sometimes just hatred and, you know, a lot of times people in our community, they get upset. But, you know, we had to make sure that we are channeling our efforts in a positive way. And I feel this organization helps students do that.
Now, when you were at Naperville, were there very many Muslims in your school?
There were, but not in my classes itself. I think there's more as I was kind of graduating, but there's quite a big Muslim population in Naperville itself.
Now, were you born in this country, or did your family come here from somewhere else?
Myself and both my older brother and sister, we were all born here. My dad came here in the late 70s for graduate school, and he married my mom, and so we've been here for, you know, quite a long time, certainly most of my life.
I see. And where did your father come from?
My parents both come from Pakistan.
Okay.
And so they grew up there, and they went through their undergrad there. And most of our family is here, but, you know, occasionally we do go back and visit, and we still keep in touch with our relatives that are there.
What kind of work do your parents do?
Sure. My dad is a computer consultant. He has his own small company. And my mom, she's a substitute teacher, and amongst many other things that she does.
Okay. And let's let our listeners get a little bit introduced to our other guest, Nasir Yahya. Nasir, your last name is spelled Y-A-H-Y-A, is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And is that, what sort of a family background do you come from?
Well, I'm born and raised south of Chicago, suburb south Chicago called Park Forest, Illinois.
Oh, I know it.
Southern Cook County limits.
Uh-huh.
So that's where I was born and raised and formed up how I view things. That type of environment. And
so what high school did you go to?
I went to Rich East High School, Rich East Rockets.
Uh-huh.
That was my high school then.
Now, you look like you might have been an athlete there. Were you?
Well, yeah, I played sports there while I was there. And it's a school where a lot of the kids come out and come together for the sake of sports. It's something that keeps the kids active.
Uh-huh.
So I played there for 4 years, football and track mainly.
Huh. What were your events in track?
I like to do the triple jump and the 200.
Huh.
Those were the things that I did when I ran track there.
Now, were you raised Muslim, or is that something that's newer for you?
Well, it's a kind of a complex question and answer to say, because you can always say yes and no to some of these philosophical questions, I guess you can say. But I started being, I was raised in a Baptist Christian household, to be direct. And I guess you can say about my sophomore year in high school, I stopped attending church, and I told my parents that just my belief system was a bit different than theirs. I still believed in God, though.
Uh-huh.
And then a couple years later, I was reading some things about Malcolm X and the things that he had seen when he went to the Hajj in Mecca, where he saw Muslims with blonde hair and blue eyed, these
sure.
things.
And he was quite surprised at that.
Quite surprised, and it surprised me also,
yeah.
because I never came upon that that portion of Malcolm X's life. I never heard about that portion of his life, and so that's what made me interested in it. And I went to go get a book that summer, the summer of my senior year before I came to school here. And that's when I first found out about Islam, and I just felt that it was a summary of what I believed in.
Now, often when young people are during that age where they're trying to decide things for themselves and they're making decisions about their own religious paths, it's difficult because their parents have made other decisions. Was that a problem in your house?
Well, the good thing that I was blessed with is that I come from a very close-knit family.
Okay.
We have a lot of extended family in the area, and we all keep in touch still now, uncles and grandparents and things like that. So what's good is that I had a good relationship with my family from the outset, and so it's a difficult thing for them to accept sometimes because
sure.
Even if I don't do it vocally, it is some of an indirect challenge to their worldview.
Sure.
But at the same time, you still are family members and you still love one another.
Now, do you have brothers or sisters who've also embraced Islam?
Well, I have two older brothers and two younger brothers, and as of now, I'm still the only Muslim in the family. So,
So you really have interesting conversations at Thanksgiving dinner table, I'm sure.
well, it is interesting. I mean, when we do talk about it, we don't talk about it that much. I don't try to bring it up too often.
Uh-huh.
But, I mean, when we do talk about it, there's usually an interest in to see whether it's similar to Christianity. There's usually a comparison to Christianity and
sure.
otherwise, and sometimes I try to divert the conversation away from that and just to talk about it on its own basis as its own kind of idea.
Right. You may not bring it up, but as I've known a few Baptists who want to challenge people who are of different faiths and try to say, well, Christians are better or Christians are...
Well, that's their opinion,
yeah.
and that's their belief. They obviously wouldn't be Christians if they thought that
sure.
there was something else out there better for them.
Sure.
And so sometimes, you know, I realize, and I think they realize, is that you can't really change a person's belief set through discourse all the time. It's something that comes from within them. They have a conviction about a thing or another, and sometimes that just can't be touched through conversation.
Yes. You know. Now, is your name, is Nasir Yahya Are either of those a choice that you've made?
Yeah, both of those are choice. Actually, okay. Yahya is Arabic for John the Baptist.
Is it?
Yeah, and it literally means like he's living, he's still alive, you know.
Oh.
And Nasir means somebody who likes to help a lot, who helps continuously. So these are both names by choice.
And are these only religious names, or have you made these your legal name as well?
No, I intend to make them my legal name, just that I've had some trouble with getting the process finished in Champaign County. But that's my intention to do so, because I see it as a reminder of my identity, because it's easy to forget who you are.
Right. Yeah. Is it difficult to change your name legally?
No, it's not actually.
Okay.
It's not, especially when you're a student here, the student legal services help you out quite a bit.
Oh, great.
With getting that process done. So it's not that difficult.
Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit about CAIR, C-A-I-R, the Council on American Islamic Relations. And Hatem, you've been involved with this for two years now on campus.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us some of the things that group has done here in central Illinois.
Sure. I mean, annually we try to put on a event called Facetathon, and that's an event that brings together people of different faiths and tries to share the common experience of going hungry and giving up food for a day. And so that's something that's done annually. And in addition to that...
And that was done this year during Ramadan.
It was. It's traditionally done during Ramadan, and we try to bring in speakers of different faiths and have people realize the importance and just the human experience of giving up food and what that draws in people in terms of gratefulness and appreciation for other people's living conditions.
Now, in the interest of full disclosure, I should admit that I was one of the speakers invited this year to speak at the Fast-a-thon.
Sure.
From a Christian perspective,
sure.
Because Christians do fast as well as,
mm-hmm.
not in the same way as Muslims, but some of it's very similar.
Right, and that's partly why we do the event, because a lot of people are unaware of the fasting traditions within their own faith.
Right.
And then
you had several other speakers from different traditions.
Mm-hmm. And I think, so the CAIR UIUC on this campus was only founded, I believe, just a few years ago, actually. It's only been here for 2 to 3 years. But in addition to that, I mean, when, like I said, one of the main objectives of the organization is to mobilize students when events happen. So when the cartoon controversy happened on the campus and the DI decided to print those cartoons, putting out an effective press release and dealing with media is one of the other objectives of the organization and what it has done in the past.
And did CAIR take a particular stance on the issue of whether the Daily Atlanta should have published those cartoons that some Muslims found offensive because of the way it depicted the Prophet?
Well, the stance, and this is an issue that's often misconstructed, again, is it wasn't a matter of freedom of press or anything. It was a matter of respect for people's beliefs and promoting understanding and justice and freedom. And we just didn't feel that printing those cartoons was advocating that. And instead, we felt that on this community, it's creating divides and putting people in uncomfortable positions, especially Muslim students on campus. So that was the position. It had, from the beginning, it had nothing to do with a freedom of press issue. It had more a respecting of each other's perspectives and beliefs. So that was the main issue that was at hand there.
And when a student publication that doesn't have any particular religious perspective, perhaps, when they have cartoons or articles or columnists write things about different religious traditions, they, of course, do have the freedom of speech to say anything they want, to print anything they want. But you're raising the issue that there are times when it can be particularly harmful to minority, to groups that are a minority group, I would think.
Yeah, and it's
if it's something like hate speech or if it's inflammatory, it can be very harmful, I suppose.
Right, and again, you know, I mean, newspaper can also print swear words, but again, it goes to responsible media. And, you know, it's very important, especially on a community like this, where the DI and the News Gazette, there is a vibrant Muslim community that's going on here. And oftentimes amongst our community, it's felt that reaching out to us, and we've tried many times to reach out to them, invite us to our event, sometimes it's not always understood, and it's not always a mutual relationship. So, but one of of the positive things that happened out of that whole experience was that local, especially student leaders from the Muslim community, we were able to meet with the Daily Alani board. I wasn't here on campus, but my older sister was here, was active at that time. And so that was one of the positives, and just kind of build, like I said, understandings and relationships so that, like I said, we can promote understanding amongst different communities.
I noticed that the Daily Alani did have a Muslim columnist, has had a Muslim columnist a time or two.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, so that's definitely been positive.
And given more, I guess, opportunity for Muslims to be heard on the campus.
Sure.
How many Muslims are in the Champaign-Urbana community at this point? Do you have any idea?
I'd say somewhere like 1,300.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh,
mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that's certainly been a growing community.
Mm-hmm. Actually, the mosque here was started by what eventually became the mosque. Was originally started by a small group of students who got together. And they used to pray in the union, used to pray in houses, they used to pray in churches, and they eventually got the funds together to actually build a institution. And so the mosque that's here close to campus right now is a result of one small student body trying to set up a foundation for a student body that will be here in the future.
And the Muslim Student Association in this country really had its beginning here on this campus. When I was past one of the pastors at McKinley Presbyterian Church, the Friday prayers were there for many years. And I heard the story of how the Muslim students had first gathered here, and we had one of the first national gatherings of the Muslim Student Association there at McKinley. And right now I'm director of the University Y, and when I went to the Y, I heard that the Friday prayers had been at the Y before they'd gone to McKinley, when there was the smaller rooms there were used by the Muslim students. So I'm very, very proud personally of that good relationship that two Christian groups had with Muslim students here over many decades.
Yeah, I just wanted to go in. Just one other thing about our organization is, and we'll probably get into this a little later, is one of the main responsibilities that we feel is just opening up people's understandings of the issues that are going on and how Muslims perceived. And that's, again, can be done in so many different ways. And one of the things that we've started to do is just hold documentary showings of, so for example, last semester we held a documentary showing of Road to Guantanamo. And a lot of people, we had a very positive response, were unaware of the conditions that inmates were facing. And so this is another way that our organization functions in terms of, again, trying to just empower citizens and encourage peaceful understanding and dialogue of different.
And what kind of response do you get when you have events like that? Do non-Muslim students attend things like your documentary film showings very much?
I think, this is one of the first ones, but for that one in itself, we held it in La Casa, and we had a very good showing. I'd say over half the students there were people who were unaware of the issue or unaware of the issue, in general, and so they definitely enjoyed coming there and learning about the different perspectives out there.
Good.
So it was very positive.
Okay. And what's your experience been, Nasir, in terms of when people find out you're a Muslim? You're from the South Side of Chicago. And you, in conversation with people in classes or bowl sessions or whatever, this comes up. What's their response been to you? You've been on this campus 4 years. What kind of experiences have you had?
Well, my experiences haven't been bad at all. It depends on the people. I mean, when people come here to the University of Illinois, it's not just meeting Muslims for the first time or anything like that. There's people who have never gone to school with people of another race before they've come to the University of Illinois.
Sure.
So this is just a general issue here, is that a lot of times people come from very different areas and they come here and they go to school and they stay in those very different groups for the 4 or 5 years that they're here. They don't interact with other people. So that's just a problem in general. But people, when they see something or hear something new and different, most people are generally open to discuss. And something I think that people don't think about or realize much is that Muslims are human beings, and Islam is basically an idea. It's an idea that can be taken by Eskimos, it can be taken by Australians, it can be taken by Russians, etc. So the thing is that I'm still a human being from Illinois, you know, and that people interact with you kind of on the way that you interact with them. And so people have generally been, you know, just inquisitive about certain things. Other people don't care much about religion and just want to talk about culture or just talk about who you are as an individual. So that's
sure.
It's just different for different people, you know.
Let me take another moment to introduce our guest for listeners who may have joined us after the beginning of this Keeping the Faith program. Today we're talking about Islam in relation to Western civilization. It's given a very broad topic. We're talking with two students, and the person whose voice you were just hearing, Nasir Yahya, is about to graduate senior. What have you been studying, Nasir?
I'm studying sociology.
Sociology, mm-hmm. Okay. And we're also talking to a sophomore who is on the board of the Council on American Islamic Relations here at the University of Illinois campus. Both are active in CIMIC, the Central Illinois Mosque and Islamic Center on Lincoln Avenue. And our second guest is Hatim Rahman. And so if listeners want to call in with a question or a comment, we're eager to have you participate. So do give us a ring, 333-9455 for listeners in Champaign-Urbana. That's 333-WILL. Elsewhere, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455. And our technical director, Brett Polson, will answer the phone and get you in the queue here in the lineup to talk with us live on the radio. And this is a weekly show, and we're always happy to have people join the conversation. We have a couple of callers right now. Let's go to line number one. Yes, you're on the air. Line number one.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. I wanted to ask one question. Since this is about keeping the faith, I wanted to ask whether or not this idea is to have good relations between cultures. Thank you.
Thank you for the question. So is that one of the things that motivates a Muslim to be a part of a group like the Council on American Islamic Relations?
I think definitely. I mean, just taking from the prophetic tradition of reaching out and understanding, embracing each other as individuals and working together in terms of figuring out what are the issues that unite us as a community. Because like Nasir was saying, at the end of the day, we're human beings in the same community and we have to live together and work together. And so understanding that and taking that from that, again, from this coming from our prophetic tradition of acknowledging that and working together on issues that unite us and again, just understanding our differences. So definitely in terms of working together with different cultures is something that is very important and why many people join the organization.
Well, let's talk a little bit about why that can be difficult for some Americans to understand. Why do some Americans feel that there's sort of only one kind of Muslim? I mean, here there are 1.2 billion in the world, but Americans somehow think there's only one kind of Muslim and they're violent or they're out to kill all Americans or whatever.
In my opinion, that comes by experience. The more experience that they have with people, the less that those stereotypes can hold up because they don't last through experience. But then also, number two, I think it's sad. If you go to some of the bookstores and things like that, the books that are bestsellers are often these things that are kind of polemical, and they don't really give a very detailed, in-depth look at other people, let alone the people within this country. And it's kind of sad. Even sometimes you see in the presidential debates, very complex issues are summed up in bullet points, you know, and so it's difficult for people. Whether it's because they don't have much time in the day to go out and investigate extra things or because they're not maybe around people who are not of their same group to be able to have those type of experiences, to be exposed to things that are a little bit different than, you know, a quick statement here or there.
I think definitely sometimes it's a lack of exposure. And when these people aren't, if you look at then what are they actually exposed to? And, you know, currently it's a constant stream of negative stories that often kind of racialize Muslims as one single group of people, which is totally, you know, ridiculous. Because, I mean, one of the things that, you know, many people that I find when I tell them that, you know, what do you think of Muslims? And do you know that there are actually more Muslims in China than Saudi Arabia? and people are like, you know, that kind of shakes their view a little bit. And then, you know, just recently, you know, I'll send a story again, going back to what are people tuning into in the limited time they are. And there was just a study done and commissioned by a mayor in London, where he found that 91% of the stories that were being published about Muslims were negative. And so, which is again failing to recognize the diversity in the Muslim community and how many different things that are going on and positive things that all the different people in this community are doing. So I think there's a couple of different reasons, but one of them again is just that the actual sources that they might even be tuned into in the national media aren't doing a very good job of promoting understanding.
On today's All Things Considered, there were two stories that involved Islam. One was the current story that people may have heard about in other places about the middle-aged woman teacher in the Sudan who her students named a teddy bear Muhammad. And she was arrested. This was a story that made the news around the world. There are people in England, you know, who are protesting her having been arrested for this. But these are the kind of stories that tend to get heard. And yes, there are Muslims in England who are saying, you know, we don't agree with what the Muslims in this particular incident did in the Sudan. But that's the kind of thing that gets press. Do you think it's a sign of prejudice in the American press?
Yeah, I mean, I like to make a point on it. I think that sometimes the stories that get magnified are those which tend to amplify what are the already existing prejudices that may be there. And these type of ideas do exist where Islam and Muslims are seen as the other who is innately opposed to rational thinking. There are people who blindly follow dictates of religion, even if it's about something like a teddy bear and a school teacher. They will follow it to the T without using their brain to think about what are some easier ways to solve the problem. And I think that you see that a lot of the stories, I mean, you'll find stories from the most remote parts of India about some a personal situation between a man and his wife will make it out to the international press.
Sure.
Because in my opinion, it supports these kind of ideas that people find as either entertaining. They're finding Islam as a source of entertainment or Muslims as a source of entertainment, or it promotes their view that things are justified looking at Muslims as a group of people who are not fit as they are to be participants in the 21st century world, right, that we're trying to create here.
There, of course, are people who do the same thing about other religions. I know some people tar all Christians with the same brush and say, well, all Christians believe what Pat Robertson believes or what a snake handler in West Virginia believes or something. So I know that happens, but it doesn't seem to happen as much in this country, at least.
Right. I think that's the problem here is that, you know, as Nasir was saying, that there are individuals in every community, in every group that do things that, you know, they're just trying to kind of strange, but that we have to resist the temptation to take that individual's action and project it on a whole community and faith group.
We have another caller waiting on line one. Now let's bring him or her into the conversation. Yes, line number one.
I am here.
Yes.
For people who want to get over what they feel are some prejudices against Islam, I'd suggest that they might visit the mosque and cultural center on Lincoln Avenue. I've been there a couple times. They have events sometimes to which the public is invited. And I found it really quite a bit different than I thought it was going to be. The first time I went, I didn't know what, you know, I was a little fearful and I didn't know what was going on. And as I was going in, I took off my shoes because I saw that was the thing to do. And I stopped at a bulletin board and was looking at the notices on the bulletin board. And one of them was the schedule for the Islamic youth day camp for the summer. And they had a week-by-week schedule, and each day there were some things that were done every day, but there were special activities for each day. And for this week, I was looking at Monday's special activity was rollerblading, and Tuesday's special activity was sand volleyball, and Wednesday's special activity was swimming, and it was noted there were separate times for boys and girls. They wouldn't be swimming together. And I can't remember Thursday, but I looked at this and I thought, so this is what they do at Moslem day camp for youth, rollerblading, sand volleyball. This is quite different than I had expected. And as I was in the mosque and talked to some people, I realized what a diverse group of people this was. I had thought I was going to a kind of monolithic group of people all believing in one thing, and while that's true, they are all Muslims and the service is in Arabic, there were people speaking many different languages from many different countries, some, you know, native Champaign-Urbana residents in Chicago, but Arabs and Persians and Turks, and, you know, because of the diverseness of the university. And what I found was that really, instead of a monolithic group, in some ways this was a melting pot in the great American tradition. And I feel like a lot of people could benefit by just going to the mosque and kind of picking up on the vibe and learning a little bit. And maybe your guests could talk about how they might, how visitors might do that to be most welcome. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for the suggestion. So if someone wants to visit the mosque here in central Illinois at on Lincoln Avenue, it's just north of Green Street, between Green Street and Springfield on Lincoln Avenue. There's a place to park behind the mosque off of Busey. Mm-hmm. That's free. When might someone go, and when would you suggest someone go to visit the mosque?
It depends on if they're alone or with a group and what they feel comfortable with. Some people would rather go there when there's almost nobody there.
Yeah.
Other people like to go there when there's a lot of people there, so they just blend in. But if the people want to visit the masjid of the mosque, they can email Cimic, C-I-M-I-C, at prayernet.org. Or they can call 344-1555, and they can come as an individual or as a group, generally between 1 o'clock and, because of this time of year, about 7:30 at night. It's generally open between those two times. And so people can come and they can just see the facility, maybe meet some people. If they don't want to meet people, that's fine too. But it's generally open between those two times during the year.
So it's possible to just stop in sometime during the week between 1 and 7 in the afternoon. But if people want to make an appointment, talk with someone, they can call and leave their name, or they can email. Again, the email address is Cimic, C-I-M-I-C, at prairienet.org, or they may call 217-344-1555 to make an appointment if they want to have someone show them around.
Yeah, and, you know, again, thank you for the call, and it was really nice to hear their experience and their interaction with the mosque. And I think, again, for more information, they can also go online at cimic.org. But one of the other big, I guess, as Nasir was saying, depending on how you'd like to visit the mosque, one of the bigger events that is specifically geared biannually, there's open houses done at the mosque where we encourage anybody to come. It's usually on an issue that many people want to find out about. For example, last semester it was done on what is jihad, and it was a very positive experience for many people. And recently we did a open house on reflections on beauty. So there's, you know, just keeping a lookout. There's constantly where there are events going on where we welcome people who want to just find out more, just want to talk, or just want to observe, to come on in and check it out.
Let me just point out a couple things for people visiting the mosque for the first time. It is handicap accessible, so people in wheelchairs can easily go in on the Busey entrance, I guess, from Lincoln. It is customary to remove your shoes. Why is that done?
Well, it's customary to remove your shoes in the prayer area. The masjid is a larger building that isn't just the prayer area. But generally, that's done to keep the services clean in the institution in general. But it's also, you know, because people, as a sign of respect to the prayer area, not to carry their shoes or any type of things that could be carried under their shoes, you know, into the prayer area where people are praying, because that's a place that we'd like to keep it as clean as possible.
And people, one reason you want to keep it clean is the people are kneeling there, they're putting their foreheads down to the floor, so it's a matter of cleanliness.
Yeah, and also, too, when the caller was talking, I think something that a lot of people who visited the masjid when I was there, they kind of surprised to see that in the main prayer area, it's not only just a prayer area, but also sometimes you see children playing tag between the two walls, or you find a lot of kids being really either rowdy or just being kids inside the actual main prayer area. So it's a place where people come and play ping pong or taekwondo, and like he was saying, all those events he didn't think people would do, that all those type of things go on inside the masjid as well.
Now, the word you're using is spelled?
M-A-S-J-I-D. And that
refers to the whole mosque, the whole building.
It means just a place of prostration, just a
place of prayer.
We're trying to kind of get that word into the common vocabulary, because people are very used to mosque, and try to get that in there too as another word.
That's an Arabic word.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Let me just take a minute. We're a little bit over halfway through our program today. Let me encourage other callers to join us, 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana. If it's a long-distance call, 1-800-222-9455. And for people who may have joined us later, if you missed the first part of the program and would like to hear it, this will be on the WILL website. It'll be archived there. So you can go to WILL.UIUC.edu, and then go to AM and look for Keeping the Faith, and you'll see all of our programs there. This will be there for a number of years. So if you want to hear this, refer other people to the program. That's where you can find it. We're talking again with Hatim Rahman from the Council on American Islamic Relations here at the University of Illinois, CAIR, or CARE. And we're talking with Nasir Yahya, who is a senior in sociology and a convert to Islam. He grew up Baptist, and we're talking about Islam in relation to other parts of our great world. Let's talk a let me just tell listeners, my name is Steve Shoemaker, and I'm the usual host for this program. Next week, I'll be talking with representatives from the Catholic Student Organization at the University of Illinois, Emily Malloy and others. On December 16, my guest will be Professor Vernon Burton, author of the acclaimed The Age of Lincoln. On December 23rd, David Eisman will be my guest, and he has a modest law about cell phone use that he's going to propose and talk about. So those are some of the programs coming up here on Future Keeping the Faith programs. I see we have another caller waiting on line one. Let's include this caller. Yes, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to make a comment about what you were talking about earlier and about our various prejudices. The woman that had been arrested for the teddy bear incident, I just couldn't help think that if we had a non-Christian teacher in a very Christian community that did something similar and called the bear Jesus, I wondered what would happen with that. We don't have laws against naming religious, things, but it would still, I think, cause.
Oops, I think we lost. We lost our caller somehow. Sorry, we didn't cut you off. Maybe something happened on your end, or maybe it's a weather-related problem. But if you want to continue, please do give us a call back. It's 333-9455. But I think we got the gist of what the caller was saying, that there might well be some Christian communities that would take offense at that, and whether they would make laws or do vigilante justice, they would say to someone who named a teddy bear Jesus. I don't know. What do you think about that?
I think it might be a point, but in my mind, I feel like that is inching towards understanding that people, regardless of their religion, are still people, and that people, if they're Christians or if they're Muslims or if they're Jewish or if they're Buddhist or whatever, they still might do particular type of actions. So I just it's an indication of what the human experience may be. And to me, I think, yes, that it may happen in Christian communities or it may happen in Muslim communities, but I think something I think is so almost disastrous from these type of walls that people put up between other communities and themselves, that they don't get to see a real understanding of what it means to be human and who it means to be who you are without getting to know somebody else. I know for myself personally, I didn't really have a cognizance of myself as an American until I started meeting so many people who were not from here. And they were talking about how beautiful it was, how easy it was to travel from here to Nevada, to New Mexico, to wherever. It's things I never took into account. Or I never really understood what it was really to be a African-American minority until I met other minorities and how they navigated through the society. So these type of things are some of the tragedies of these stereotypes and prejudices, where you cannot really have a full understanding and comprehension of who you are without being able to meet other people who are also human beings going through some of the similar circumstances, but see things from a very different angle. And what can you learn from them? And this is something that's lost a lot.
This year you mentioned being an African-American minority who then chose to switch from being a part of the Christian majority in this country. And, of course, as you said your family was Baptist. And I spent some time in North Carolina where we had a joke that there were more Baptists than people in North Carolina. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were just millions of Baptists in that state. But you chose to become sort of a double minority. Was that something you consciously were aware of when you were making the decision to join, to become a Muslim?
That's not something I was really thinking about, because at that time I was still pretty young, about 17 years old and about 25 now. And so it was something that I just, from my background, my father and my parents had raised me up, you know, if you think something's true, if you think something's right to do it, then you go ahead and do it. Uh-huh. And so it was just a matter, in a sense of like an obligation of being true to who I felt my identity was, or to who I felt that guy was. But that being a double minority is a difficult transition for converts, whether they're in America, whether they're black or white or Latino or whatever, because even for whites who may consider themselves part of the majority society when they become Muslims, they're a racial minority within the Muslim category.
Yes.
And they become somewhat isolated and ostracized from their own communities, possibly. And families are sometimes tough. Some families are more understanding. But as African-American, yes, I was had an understanding of life as a minority. But the thing is, in the South Side of Chicago, there are so many African-Americans that you don't feel it as much, you know. But coming down here into Champaign-Urbana, it was kind of a double minority feeling. And you try to connect with people as people as much as possible. And there's another African-American convert I met while I was here. I met quite a few. But he was saying that one of the toughest things for him as being a Muslim was to try to remove a lot of the remnants of racism that he had in his heart towards other people, but that he felt that it was a religious obligation for him to remove so that he could interact with people as people. And that's something that you really don't see until you are in a close proximity with people for an extended period of time, is who you really are and what your views really are. As long as you're separated from people at a distance, you can always say, hey, you know, I'm all for human rights and justice for people in general, but, you know, close interaction changes your self-perception.
You know? Tim, your family, your parents came from Pakistan, but you were born in this country, mm-hmm. and so you're an American born and bred, and yet as a Muslim, did you feel that you were treated as a foreigner sometimes just because of that?
I don't think so, really. I've been fortunate enough to be in communities, like they said, that a lot of them were not necessarily treating me as foreign, more curious of what I was. And it was only maybe when we would cover the Islam chapter in geography or history where I'd have to get up, I would be the only one, or during, you know, the month of Ramadan when I wouldn't be eating. That's maybe a little bit, but I generally say that it was more met with curiosity and wanting to learn more about who I was and what I believed in. And like I said, I was able to grow up in my community for quite a long time. And when 9/11 happened, a lot of people, they didn't, you know, ostracize me or anything because they grew up with me and they had that understanding of who I was and what I believed in. And they automatically, you know, they asked me what this was about, and they, again, gave the benefit of the doubt. So I think overall I've had a very positive experience.
When many Americans equate Islam with violence, how do you respond?
Well, see, I think this is something interesting, and you know, it goes back to the question of why this is being done and how this is being done. Because if as Nasir was saying, and from our experiences, people form their opinions based on what they hear. And to me, this notion of associating Islam and as one group of people with violence, I think it's something that is being done. This idea is constantly pushed by a very small group of people that's actually doing this. And they're trying to instill fear in anxiety in people, because it's when people are fearful and they have anxiety, it's easier to kind of manipulate them. And we saw that with the Patriot Act and many other things. So I think, you know, dealing with this, again, it just goes down to your personal interactions with them, inviting them into taking proactive steps. I mean, generally, like I said, I think there's very few people that I've ever met who have just, you know, accused you of something and not let you respond and said, that's what I'm going to have no matter what. With those type of people, you know, it's hard to have any type of discourse, no matter what their thought or belief is. But generally, when, you know, it's, you have to acknowledge that this idea that people associate with Islam and terror is out there. And so then the question becomes, what as Muslims and as Americans are we doing to combat that? And that's what, you know, KRUIC, CIMIC, and all the other organizations that we try to combat that by inviting people to come and look and see who we are and what we do.
Now, I've heard the verses from the Quran that people often quote to say, well, we'll see right here in the holy book of Islam, there's a call for violence. And I've heard other passages from the Quran that are quoted by people in the Council of American Islamic Relations or IFF, the Intercultural Friendship Foundation, or various leaders from the mosque that say, no, the Muslims are called to peace, we're called to be peacemakers. How do Muslims decide which portions, which sentences are more important?
In my opinion, I think something that's maybe important, I think just for general discussion, even before you refer to like the Quranic passages, is I think there needs to be more discussion amongst the general population, and it's something that's kind of a detriment because of the environment of suspicion and fear nowadays, just about the ethics of war and why is war waged in general, and what are certain practical on the ground reasons for why people fight one another, and historical reasons for why people fight one another, to remove ourselves from kind of going straight to one verse or one idea and trying to extrapolate from that what should be done or what could be done or why are things done the way that they are. Because I think a lot of times, if you look into history, you'll see that not only were Muslims and Christians or people of different religions fighting each other or being at peace with each other at different circumstances, but there were also times when Muslims were allied with Christians in fighting other Muslims, or Muslims and Christians were allied in fighting Christians.
Sure.
And so it's obviously
like
a much more complex picture than what people are giving it to when they're going back and referring to, well, this verse says that. Obviously, people are nowadays tied to a nation, or they're tied to a local community, something like that. So it has to be made more complex before we just jump into that.
I want to hear, Hatim, your response to that, but let's take a question first from line number one. Yes, you're on the air. Line number one.
Steve, you and I met in an art gallery in Urbana. You sound awful. I hope you get home and get better.
Oh, thank you. I do have a bad cold.
Yeah. And meanwhile, I was thinking about prejudice and so forth. You're taller than anybody on the face of the planet, as I remember. But I'm thinking about the fact that I'm Islamic and so forth. And, you know, you cannot characterize us and the things that we believe in the way that people are trying to do. I would never go out and hurt somebody and so forth. So I think religious fanaticism is religious fanaticism. And I will hang up and hear the discussion.
Well, thank you for that. What about that?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, you have to treat you have to kind of be realistic about what these problems are and what's driving them. And I think you know, like we've kind of said here, that Islam and Muslims and people in general, they're very diverse. A group of people, and a lot of times it's their experience and interactions that forms their thoughts and their experiences. And there's been numerous sociological, psychological studies that have been done on this subject and trying to pinpoint them and the causes. And almost, you know, again and again, they come back with the same conclusion that it's multiple causal factors that influence somebody's behavior, whether it's to go to one stream or one extreme or the other. And understanding that is important, and not simplifying our logic and our ability to say somebody's acting like this just because of this reason. It's very simple. It's very easy to do so, but we have to avoid doing that because it's just not treating the situation in reality.
When you were first reading the Quran, did you come across parts of it that you said, gee, I'm not sure if that's a universal principle, or I'm not sure that applies to me, or I'm not sure that's right? I mean, I've certainly had that reaction to reading parts of the Bible.
I think, luckily, one of the things that's really stressed in our prophetic tradition just generally is that whenever you're reading about in the Quran, you always sit with somebody who's more knowledgeable than you. And so this is something for me that's always been done whenever I've been sitting and studying. So because it's natural, like you said, it's natural to have questions about what you're reading, and especially if you don't know the language that it's coming from. So, you know, what is this verse referring to, and what is the context that it is? So these questions have definitely come up, but, you know, I've been lucky enough to sit with people who have an understanding of the verses that are there and you know, where they come from and the context and what they apply to and who they apply to, especially when you're dealing with a translation, translated verse. And, you know, you have to understand, you know, where this verse is coming on and who it is actually addressing. So, let's see here.
When you come to verses that you don't, you're saying the question was, you come to verses that you don't necessarily agree with. I think something that comes with that is being able to investigate things over time and not to come to quick conclusions. Whenever you're investigating something, especially if it's a religious matter or something that can have many different meanings, then you have to go and investigate carefully and slowly. And this is something that was really articulated well by a man by the name of Ibn Haytham. He died in 1039 in Cairo. He was considered the father of modern optics and the scientific method. And he was describing his method for investigating existing things in life. And he was saying that a lot of the problems are reasons that people come into conflict with one another over ideas. In this case, he was talking about vision, how vision comes about, is that some people end their investigation too quickly. Or some people are using arguments that are not based on sound premises. So he's just saying that you have to be able to investigate. He's saying you have to be able to investigate carefully and slowly and not come to quick conclusions just about something like vision, let alone whether or not you should go and do a particular action or not, you know. So it's something that's a part of character, that you should be slow to come to conclusions on matters like that.
Well, let me give an example of that from my religious tradition, which is Christian. There are several places in the New Testament where the Christian scriptures, the Greek scriptures, where Jesus is quoted as saying, I have come not to bring peace, but a sword. Mm-hmm. And Christians, you know, are named Christians because they're trying to follow the teachings of Jesus, the way of Jesus, to believe in Jesus. And, you know, when I came across that for the first time, I thought, am I supposed to be a warrior? Am I supposed to be am I supposed to kill people? I know I had those questions.
Yeah, I make a point I think is kind of interesting. Sometimes I know a lot of times we say, you know, Islam and Christianity are so similar. But I think there's an issue. I mean, you can correct me if I'm wrong. I think there's an issue that a lot of times people don't discuss, is that Islam had the fortune of being able to have a protected or secure environment within which the people could practice freely while Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, was still alive. And I think, if I remember correctly, that the Christians while Jesus was alive, had never really had opportunity to be free and be open and to like establish a state or something like that. So what had developed relatively early on within Islam was the practice of jurisprudence. And so the scholars were trying to deduce from statements that they had heard and read from Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, what actions that could be taken. And this tradition has been like continuous since Prophet Muhammad's time. So it's not so much, it's less within the hands of the person just to go out and make their own interpretation or understand of a thing without first consulting what is the history behind it and what have people recorded and said about these type of action in these particular circumstances.
And this point that you brought up is actually, now that I recall, it's one of the most, to me, one of the most amazing verses in the Quran, where kind of what you're saying, it's chapter 3 and it's verse 7, where it says that, you know, that for those of you who want to look at unclear verses, you know, they will look at the unclear verses and they'll form their quick opinions as they will. But, and of course, I'm paraphrasing here, but for those of you whose hearts are pure and well-intentioned, you know, they'll find the true meaning in the Quran. And that was one of the most amazing verses that I read, especially when I got a little bit older and when I came back on that verse. So it's, you know, it's a point that's it was well taken, that, you know, you have to be you have to be careful and in your judgments and kind of just take your time in judging certain verses.
We've been talking about keeping the faith today about Islam in relation to Christianity and other religions, other cultures. Our two guests have been Hatim Rahman, who is a sophomore and on the board of the Council on American Islamic Relations. We've also been talking with the senior, Nasir Yahya, who is a convert to Islam from Christianity. His parents are Baptists, and we've appreciated very much their conversation here on the radio. I apologize again for my bad voice today, but I've got some kind of allergy or cold or something. I'll try to be better by next week. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these programs. I'm the director of the University YMCA on campus, which is the oldest student organization on campus. It's been at the U of I for 134 years. The Y began as a Christian organization, but soon became open to people of other faiths, and we're very happy to say that we have many people involved in the Y who are Muslims and Jewish and Hindu, and as well as Christian or people of no faith, no particular religious tradition. The Y is involved in developing student leaders by providing opportunities for community service and social action. The Y is one of the sponsoring groups who contributes to this program. Another is the Ridge Road Tree Farm, which this kind of time of year is selling Christmas trees to people who'd like an experience to go out into the country south of Urbana and cut down a Christmas tree. You can go to ridgeroadtreefarm.com to learn about it, or give them a call at 684-2535. Thank Ridge Road Tree Farm for their support for Keeping the Faith and WILL. Next week, I'll be interviewing here on Keeping the Faith representatives from the Catholic Campus Ministry, Emily Malloy from Focus, active in the Newman Center. The following week, Vernon Burton will be our guest, talking about his book, The Age of Lincoln. Thanks for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Tariq Ramadan is a controversial philosopher who believes Muslims can thrive in secular Western society. Ayan Hirsi Ali, an equally controversial figure who's living under a death threat, disagrees. I'm Jim Fleming. Next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk with both of these impassioned activists. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7 here on WILL Urbana. Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, mostly cloudy during the evening, then clearing late. Colder with a low in the mid-20s. Blustery with northwest winds 20 to 25 miles per hour. Tomorrow, mostly sunny and much colder with a high in the mid-30s and west winds 10 to 15 miles per hour with morning gusts to 25 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with a low in the mid-20s and west winds 5 to 10 miles per hour.
WILL programming is funded in part by a grant from TK Service Center, 806 Perkins Road in Urbana, offering automotive repair on cars and trucks by ASE-certified technicians. In business since 1984, they perform computerized engine diagnostics, alignments, brake, suspension, preventative maintenance, and other repairs. A shuttle service for customers is also available, 344-0800 or on the web at tkservicecenter.com.
It's 6 p.m. This is